Good afternoon, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Health and Social Services Committee to order. The time is 1:37, first of April 2015. With me today, Senator Stoltz, Senator Geisel, myself, Stedman. Senator Kelly will not be joining us today as there's operating budget issues in finance, and Senator Ellis will probably be along later. We do have a quorum to conduct business. We are going to continue working on SB 78, which is the governor's Medicaid expansion bill, followed with SB 74, some cost containment. But what we're going to do initially here is we're going to have a presentation from Ledge Finance dealing with Medicaid comparisons and fiscal note issues. And just for everybody's clarification, we will then have a few questions, and then we're going to have a public hearing portion of the bill on both bills. And there will be no meeting Friday. This bill is being worked in the, I guess, in the offices. It's rather complex, and we're trying to sort through some issues. And we'll be back at this table next week to try to wrap some of this stuff up. With that, I'd like to go ahead and invite the representative from Ledge Finance to introduce herself, who she represents, and remind the audience that Ledge Finance is a nonpartisan legislative finance arm of the legislature. And the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Amanda Ryder. I work with the Legislative Finance Division. And in the last meeting, you had asked me to bring some graphs. They did a couple of things. Showed the difference between SB 74 and SB 78. You would ask for a little bit more detail on some historical graphs, as well as to use the FY 12 to 15 growth rate numbers, and then also present some inflation-adjusted historical graphs. So I will be starting and just moving through these. Okay, this first graph shows the differences in general funds only between SB 74 and 78. I would like to note that the axis on the left starts at 500 million to 700 million. So if you started at zero, the differences would look considerably less than this. But as you can see, the green line. Let me see if I can get some sort of, here. The green line is SB 78. The red line is SB 74. As you can see, there are some savings in SB 74 to the governor's amended budget. And this line includes the governor's amended budget, and it includes the funding for, that includes Medicaid expansion in this. If you have questions about certainly the drop downs, you can talk to John about that. This next slide shows the total funds, all funds, and the comparisons between the fiscal notes, and this is Medicaid only.
Yeah, we'll have a brief Eddie's. Welcome back on the record. Go ahead.
As you can see in this slide, the governor's budget increases Medicaid from a baseline of $1.8 billion to about $1.9 billion. And while the SB 74 goes to about $1.79, so it saves several million, SB 74 does. But this is all funds. These next slides were really kind of, I have done a couple of things with these. On the left axis is the budget dollars, and this is general funds only, and these give you the budget history for Medicaid. And on the right is the cost per recipient. I took the number of enrollees from FY06 through FY14 that are actual enrollees, and 15 and 16 are projected. And the 16 numbers does include the projected Medicaid expansion numbers, since these are the governor's budget numbers. And as you can see, budget is gone. This is nominal dollars. And on your handout, I did want to just correct, at the very top, it says FY14 dollars on the handout. This, and that is not accurate. It is nominal dollars. All of the legends are correct. So in nominal dollars, Medicaid has gone from about 381.6 million to about 675 million. That's general funds only. But the cost per recipient has gone from about 2.8 thousand to about 3.6 thousand nominal dollars between FY06 and FY16. This next graph shows all funds, and these are again nominal dollars. Medicaid has gone from about $1.1 billion in FY06 to about $1.8 billion in FY16. And as you can see, that jump in 16, that does account for the additional $145 million-ish for Medicaid expansion. The cost per recipient goes from about $8,562 per recipient to about $9,726 with Medicaid expansion. If you excluded Medicaid expansion, if you just took that out, that would be about $10,900 per person in FY16. Now, Mr. Chairman, you had asked me to look at a couple of, inflation-adjusted numbers. So I did look at two inflation-adjusted numbers. The one below is the Anchorage CPI. It's kind of their standard inflation-adjusted numbers that we use here. And that shows that FY14 dollars, the value of that dollar is $1.22 in FY06. Well, the upper line is health care inflation. And that's extracted from the Anchorage CPI, but this just extracts the healthcare inflation piece of that. As you can see, and as we all know, the healthcare is rising at a higher rate than inflation. So, and that's what this upper red line shows. Having a little trouble finding this mouse. Anyway, so that's what the upper line shows. Basically, a dollar in FY14 was worth $1.48 in 06. And then I wanted to take a look at population growth and enrollee growth. If we're looking at numbers, I think these are two valuable pieces. You had 674,583 in FY06, rising to an estimate of $762,902. And the number of enrollees, that's an increase of about 13%, and 15 and 16 are estimates. The estimated enrollees, the Medicaid enrollees, Medicaid enrollees were about 131,996 enrollees in 2006, and without Medicaid expansion would be about 164,453. When you include Medicaid expansion, the 20,000 or so enrollees, you're going up to about 184,000 enrollees in FY16. That's an increase of about 40% over the FY06 number of enrollees. So you go from 13% to 25% without them, and then 40% increase in the number of enrollees. This next graph, I have three lines on it. The first line, the bottom line, is the blue line, shows the Medicaid general funds nominal dollars. That's just as we budget for them. The red line is the Medicaid appropriations if you adjust for the Anchorage CPI. And that's, as always, the budget dollars are on the left. And then what I've also done is said, okay, well, adjusted for inflation, what is the cost per enrollee? And which you can see the axis on the right. So when you adjust for inflation, Anchorage CPI, the 06 numbers are almost 465 million and about 648 million in FY16. The cost per enrollee would have been $3,520 in FY06, and it's about $3,941 when you adjust for Anchorage CPI. And that's general funds only. Our next slide shows all funds adjusted for the Anchorage CPI inflation. And you go from about $1.4 billion in FY06, inflation adjusted, to about $1.7 billion in FY16. And the cost per enrollee goes from $10,421 to a peak of, in FY07 of $11,339 to about $10,480. So it's basically about flat when you look at 06 to FY16 in cost per enrollee when you account for all funds. Now this next is the health care inflation. And blue line, yet again, the bottom is the nominal dollars, and you can see the comparisons between that and the red line is accounted for health care inflation. You were about $526 million in FY06, going to about $639 million in FY16. Cost per enrollee is about $3,989 of general funds versus $3,889 in FY16 when you account for health care inflation. And with all funds, I probably don't need to restate the blue line is the is nominal. Red line is inflation adjusted healthcare CPI, and you go from $11,811 in 06 to about $10,343 when you account for inflation cost per enrollee. You would also ask for projected growth, and in the last presentation I had used a projected growth rate of, I had used projected growth rate from 06 to 16 and then 12 to 16, and you had requested that because the 15 numbers are more final, that I use the 12 to 15 numbers. And so this next graph is really just reflecting a growth rate. When you look at 06 to 15 in general funds, your annual average growth rate is 6.88% between 06. This is nominal dollars. I did not do inflation adjusted because projecting into the future, I think would probably confuse people. So this is based on our current budget moving forward. And so the projected annual growth between 12 and 15 is 3.14%. And this really just shows the differences between those two. As I stated in the earlier presentation, I certainly believe the 06 to 16 numbers are too high. I mean, I think there's definitely been a downward trend, and I think nationally they're expecting healthcare at least to not grow at quite the rates that it was growing. Whether the 3.14%, it may be too low. That's who knows. But anyway, that is just based on recent growths in Medicaid, in the Medicaid program and general funds. This next graph is all funds, and it's just the projected growth. 06 to 16, you had an average annual growth rate in all funds of about 4.43%, and in which is the, if you extend that growth rate out, that's the red line above. And then when you look at the 12 to 15 annual average growth rate of 3.2%, if you extend that out, you end up with a budget of about $2.3 billion in FY24 versus a $2.5 billion if you use the 06 to 15 annual average growth rate.
Okay. We have initial questions from the committee members or observations.
Stunned into silence, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Well, it's kind of interesting when you take into account inflation and population growth. It's not as scary as it would appear on the surface, but then again, our revenue isn't tied to inflation growth and population, or inflation and population growth, unfortunately. Seeing no other questions for ledge finance, you can relax for a minute and then run away. Mr. Sherwood, could you introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and I think Senator Stoltz had a question you want to help him with.
Thank you, Senator Sidman. For the record, my name is John Sherwood. I'm Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services. In the last meeting, Senator Stoltz asked a question about a provision in SB 78, Section 2, which had to do with the permanent fund dividend hold harmless provisions. So I wanted to do my best to explain that. I would have to say it's probably the most complicated piece of the entire bill. And to do that, I think I have to give a little bit of background about one of the changes in the Affordable Care Act that happened, which was, by way of background, Medicaid historically used rules for counting income that were derived from cash assistance programs. For individuals who were aged, blind, or disabled, those rules were derived from the Supplemental Security Income Program administered by the Social Security Administration, with some changes. But for children, parents and caretaker relatives, pregnant women, those rules were derived from the old Aid to Families with Dependent Children Cash Assistance Program, which was subsequently replaced by the Temporary Assistance Program, or TANF. With the Affordable Care Act, the rules for children, pregnant women, parents and caretaker relatives were changed from those rules to income rules to rules that were based on modified adjusted gross income, or really tax rules for counting income. That included not only the rules for what income is counted, how it's valued, but also who is considered in the household. So there were a variety of different changes that happened to those rules. One of the differences is that the old rules would take a gross income amount and then apply income disregards for things like child care expenses, certain deductions from earned income to offset work expenses. There were a number of different ones. One of the ones that Alaska applied was a disregard of the permanent fund dividend income. We did not count the permanent fund dividend income. There's a state statute that says assistance programs are not to count the dividend income unless required to by federal law, and it provides for a hold harmless provision that says if you're required to count it and it makes you ineligible, you can continue to receive benefits at state expense, and it's paid out of the dividend account, not out of the general fund. But you can continue to receive benefits for up to 4 months if the disregard makes you ineligible. Now, under the old rules, income was always treated as point of time. So if you got it in that month, you counted it in that month. Under the new modified adjusted gross income rules, in the exchange, it's annualized. And the reason that's significant is because the notion of using those rules for Medicaid is so people could move back and forth smoothly as their income changed between the exchange and Medicaid and not face some sort of cliff of losing eligibility for the exchange but not quite fitting into Medicaid if their income became too low. So states, as they went forward implementing these rules, were required to adjust their income standards to reflect the loss of these disregards. And so we were instructed essentially to raise our income standards by an amount equivalent, an average amount equivalent to the disregards that were lost. And the federal government provided us some assistance in calculating this. But the state of Alaska, like every other state, was forced to convert all of its standards for children, pregnant women, and parents and caretaker relatives to these new MAGI standards. So effectively, the income standard increased, but the amount of income we counted against that standard also increased at an equivalent amount. I can't say that it's always perfect for every individual, but there's an equivalency there. Because the expansion group was not an existing category, there is no provision for making such a conversion or increasing the income standard to reflect the loss of the permanent fund dividend disregard. And because the income is annualized, the permanent fund hold harmless statute doesn't really provide protection for those individuals in the same way it was intended to originally. As we looked at the practical ways we could manage that problem and try and resolve the two statutes for the expansion group, we saw no easy solution. And we were very aware that individuals, if receipt of the dividend in the expansion group, if receipt of the dividend made them ineligible, they would be, for Medicaid, they would be eligible to receive subsidized insurance coverage through the exchange with minimal premiums or cost sharing. And I would just point out that adults on Medicaid are also subject to certain cost sharing. So again, it would be a relative minor loss of benefits as a result of it, and it would solve an administrative problem that would be very difficult to manage. If an individual had come in and applied through the exchange would not recognize that they were in that situation and automatically put them in the exchange anyway and not refer them to Medicaid, because it would see their income and count it as being over income for Medicaid. As we looked at it, it just seemed like the most practical solution was to simply exempt this group from the hold harmless provision. And when those individuals who fit in that narrow band where their annualized PFD income put them over for Medicaid, they would receive substantially subsidized coverage through the exchange. For all existing beneficiaries, first, the aged and blind and disabled categories, none of those individuals would be impacted by this at all. The same rules apply. There's still a hold harmless provision on the books, although Medicaid is allowed, approved to disregard the dividend as income and resources for those categories. For the individuals in the existing MAGI categories, our existing coverage of children, pregnant women, parents and caretaker relatives, there is no direct hold harmless or disregard, but we have made the adjustment to the income standard so that it reflects approximately the value, the annualized value of the dividend. So there is, as best we could, reconciling the state and federal law, we have kept that those existing groups protected under our current income standards. This expansion group would be the only group that would not be protected by the hold harmless provision, and that's simply because we could not find an effective way to do it, and the loss of benefit would be really fairly minimal. So. Yeah.
That answer your question, Senator Stoltz?
Can I just ask a little elaboration? Sure. Thanks. That long answer was hard to, Mr. Chairman, to keep track. But just so Alaskans understand, on the hold harmless, we pay up to 4 months of benefits so people on welfare can continue to receive the dividend, and that comes out of every other Alaskan's dividend. And I think that's an important thing to have on the record, how that works. And what I've heard, Mr. Chairman, if you could, would like to extend that same benefit for these new potentially 42,000 people? I believe I've heard that from, that you're forced to do this.
Go ahead.
For the chair, Senator Stoltz, I think when we approach this, we looked at the question as, state law would compel us to do this, so our first step was to see if we could find a way to do it within existing state law. And lacking that, we proposed the exemption.
So, Mr. Chairman, that sounds like a yes. Their first default would have been to continue the regular hold harmless. Is that a yes?
Through through the chair, Senator Stoltz, yes, that was our first approach.
Okay. And Mr. Chairman, I just have just a couple of quick follow-ups. Is this whole issue of the dividends, does that affect just the parent applying? Does it affect each dependent dividend recipient? And how does that work for the configuration? And the other, and this is going to be too long, and is there an option under this complicated laws that where somebody could decline a dividend and be eligible, not apply for one?
Through the chair, Senator Stoltz, the second question first. There is a development of income requirements, so you're required to apply for income that you're eligible for as part of the application process. So with the exception of needs-based programs, you're not allowed to decline income solely for the purpose of qualifying for benefits.
So just one follow-up, Mr. Chairman. If a minor doesn't have their dividend applied for them, they have up till they're 18, just generally on the dividend law to apply after they reach that age of majority. Could you see a scenario where families just don't apply for the dividends for their kids? Or is there a legal requirement and then the kids can collect, they can collect the welfare benefit and then get the dividend benefit once they're 18?
Through the chair, Senator Stoltz, I would have to look into that. I'm not so versed in the development of income requirement to know how it applies if a parent is not pursuing a dividend for a child. Generally, it's not a situation that we see with most of these cases. And certainly with the expansion group, we're talking primarily about adults. Well, they're all adults, but and primarily adults who don't have children at home. And in other cases, that's not something we've ever really seen. That said, we haven't had a lot of experience with it because it's only been recently that these rules have begun applying to individuals.
Do you have another follow-up before we
Not a follow-up, but part of the question is, Mr. Chairman, is the dependents' dividend calculated as part of the whole family income and a year, and then also a year like 2008 where there was a dividend plus. Well, those are questions. I'm not advocating, Mr. Chairman, one way or another, but I think Alaskans I've found are intensely interested in the dividend issue, and I think they should understand this. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Sure.
Through the chair, Senator Stoltz, for the Magi population, the income is counted for the tax filing unit, and typically that would be the adults and their dependent children. So there are some special rules for including individuals where, say, parents residing together file separately, or also situations where an absent parent claims the individual child as a dependent. But generally, the rules follow the tax filing unit. So it would include, it would potentially include income. However, individuals who don't have to file tax returns, their incomes don't count. So for many children, and depending on the size of the dividend, they may not have to file. They may not have to file, and therefore their income would be excluded.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have another question, but I would like this in a written analysis and statement because I think it's a key component of this bill.
If you could, if the department could get back to the committee for the written explanation. If there's any confusion on what the question is, get a hold of Senator Stoltz's office. You'll clarify it and get it back to the chairman.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions before we go to the public hearing process? Okay. Thank you, Madam Commissioner.
Thank you.
And your trustee lead, Mr. Shirley. With that, we're going to go ahead and open up the public hearing process. Normally we don't like bills overlapping, but these two bills are fairly close to each other. We're going to start with Senate Bill 74, which is Senator Kelly's cost containment. And I'd like to give the people a little bit of leeway to bleed back and forth because it's so similar. We have a couple of people signed up. Ross Bellin. And then we have a list from the LIOs and other areas. We need those lists here. If you introduce yourself for the record, who you represent.
Thank you, sir. My name is Ross Bellin. I represent myself and also my company, Medical Bidline. Chairman, I'm testifying on behalf of myself and the company just referenced. We're an Alaskan company. Moreover, I am a resident of Anchorage with my wife and family. I was raised in Ketchikan in the 60s. Every minute we resided there, my father was in the Coast Guard. I'm a business person and a lawyer with 30 years' experience in the medical field. I have worked for Zimmer Orthopedics, scrubbing and surgery, teaching physicians total hip and knee implants and replacement, and other areas of orthopedic surgical applications. I've also worked with the United States Surgical Corporation, and that was with surgical stapling, scrubbing and surgery, teaching physicians the procedures for surgical stapling. My experience also extends to home health care, manufacturing, and the insurance side of reimbursement that has been the basis of most medical care discussions in conjunction with Obamacare and state health care exchanges. You've seen members of this committee. Many individuals have a false base of confidence concerning both the current scope and the potential expansion of Medicaid program. Very simply, Alaska has an unrivaled business partner in the federal government, as it is $18 trillion in debt. Bill Clinton's chief of staff, Erskine Bowles, said it best, the United States is just the last horse in line at the glue factory. The challenge for each committee member is to define reform and identify in detail in a specific, measurable, achievable, and reproducible plan of action to achieve and exceed necessary corrective financial goals and markers. I, for one, know that competitive bidding for medical equipment, surgical procedures, diagnostic testing such as MRIs is part of the goal to do those things. Medical Bidline provides competitive bidding in sample areas as follows, but limited to orthopedic services and post-op braces, drip medical equipment, surgical techniques and procedures such as total hips and knees, arthroscopies, lumbar back surgeries, colonoscopies, podiatry, chiropractic services, physical therapy services, home health care services, emergency and non-emergency transport services. The Alaska structural issues we see is a major problem because of our footprint. We must reevaluate how we look at healthcare services to individuals. The cost alone in travel in 2014 for 16,500 Native Alaskans covered under IHS was right about $90 million. That information came directly from Health and Social Services through Representative Vasquez's office. The original number was $45 million, but Bill Stewart had weighed in and said that it was actually double that amount. So we truly have a structural problem in terms of getting people to health care versus health care to people. We have bloated costs in health care due to lack of competition throughout Alaska. The fact that there has not been competition throughout Alaska in the area of health care services resulted in substantially high prices. Competitive bidding stimulates competition on every referral request. Xerox Healthcare Management Services, Alaska HSS has through Xerox paid in excess of $26,000 for a single wheelchair sent out to Western Alaska. That was shared with me directly from Bill Struer when he was commissioner of HSS. Hoyer Lifts, moving patients from bed A to bed B, ensuring there wasn't a back injury. You could buy them all day long for $2,000. The state was paying over $7,000 through Health and Social Services Xerox. They were placed in nursing homes and so forth for use there. Competitive bidding addresses and prevents these kinds of abuses. The debate rages on as to what the true cost of Medicaid expansion would be throughout Alaska. We cannot afford to get this wrong. Ensuring that we do not pay substantial monies for Medicare or medical care and procedures goes a long way to protecting the assets of a great state. Thank you, Chairman. This concludes my discussion or presentation. I would like, sir, however, to introduce a proposed amendment from the floor, if I may approach.
Well, that's all right. I'll talk to you later. We're not taking amendments right now.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
And actually, the committee members do amendments. But I take it your testimony, Mr. Ross, is to, or Bailing, is to have the opportunity for the state to lower their costs by using used equipment or reconditioned equipment.
New and used equipment.
You ran away too quick. Don't be so shy. There's only two specimens on the list. So you get a little extra time, but not much, but a little extra. So maybe shorten it up, and I know you spent a lot of time telling us who you are and all that other stuff, but make it a little more succinct. What do you want us to do to control costs?
In a nutshell, engaging in competitive bidding. We have the capability. What we do is we locate, for example, if it was equipment or services, we locate the actual providers, dealers of the manufacturers.
Maybe not so much your company, but the context of...
Yes, sir. Competitive bidding. Competitive bidding levels the playing field, first of all, from the large providers to the small providers. Case in point, Providence Medical Center, they may have their own durable medical equipment facility, which they do. They really block out through lack of competition to the smaller companies. Okay. When we do analysis on that kind of consideration, we're looking at service, pricing, doesn't matter how big or how small a provider is.
Okay.
Moreover, besides leveling the playing field, we locate the dealers for the manufacturers of this equipment, and we remove box movers that have a tendency to run those prices up much higher. Mm-hmm. One box mover buys from another one.
Right. I understand. Yep. We're not interested in so much a sales pitch, but we understand the issue is we want... You're interested in competitive bidding, and so we don't end up using a expensive wheelchair for a short time and have to buy a brand new one.
It covers both used equipment, moreover, new equipment, used equipment. And what I'm advocating is that the state go to a competitive bidding process in conjunction with the referral process where someone's calling into Xerox, for example, for authorization. At that point, it would be a handoff for the needed surgery, physical therapy, or durable medical equipment, which would then go out through competitive bidding. The state, through whatever the contact set up, would then authorize that final price, showing them the cost savings, and that would cover that price.
Okay, thank you for your testimony there. You know, to my surprise, we don't have anybody in the AFNA or in the LIOs across the state. We're being trumped by the operating budget, I guess, action upstairs. So we only have two people that signed up today. The next one up is Becky Hulbert, if she can come forward. And anybody else that would like to put their two cents in to the committee after Becky's done, we'll give you that opportunity. Or forever hold your peace. If you could introduce yourself for the record.
For the record, my name is Becky Holtberg, and I'm the president and CEO of the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association, and your second specimen of the day. So I'm here to speak to both bills, but more to speak really to the general concept of Medicaid reform. We've had a lot of conversation, some in this committee, some in others, some in the media about reform, and I want to speak a little bit to reform concepts that are in one or both bills and how those we do believe can move Medicaid forward to a more sustainable path. So ASHA supports SB 78. We also support many of the reform concepts in SB 74. And we encourage you to consider the merits of both of those bills. But specifically, we believe that it's important for reform efforts to move forward that expansion is included with them. And I'll speak to why we believe that is a necessary part of reform. It's no secret that hospitals support Medicaid expansion. Alaska hospitals provide over $100 million per year in uncompensated care, and expansion would reduce that burden. It's also no secret that we believe that expansion would provide significant fiscal and economic benefits at a time where our state budget and our state economy is desperately in need of that help. But we also support the governor's bill, and we support many of the concepts in SB 74 because we strongly believe that our healthcare system and the Medicaid program must transform. So I'm going to talk a little bit for a moment about reform and that question that the previous presenter discussed, which was what is reform. The department has already been engaged in reform of the existing Medicaid program through efforts like pharmacy management and other things. We think those are very important and should continue. But as we look at our healthcare system going forward, it's clear that that system requires a realignment of financial incentives. Under our current system, providers get paid for volume. The more things a provider does, the more they get paid. And the more times they do it, the more they get paid. But what patients and payers really want is value, high-quality care at a reasonable cost. But to get value, they have to start paying for value, and we need to have the conversation about paying for value. And that's the really hard work of payment reform, and I think is the next journey we need to make. Two really brief examples. Peace Health in Ketchikan received a CMS Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services Innovation Grant for care coordination. Through the project, which enabled them to hire care coordinators to help manage care, the facility saved money for the payers, fewer Medicare and Medicaid dollars coming in, and improved quality. Those are good outcomes, right? Not if you're the hospital, which absent the grant would have spent money to lose money to improve care. That's a model where financial incentives are not aligned. And our current payment system does not necessarily reward efficiency and quality, it rewards volume. A second project, Central Peninsula Hospital in Soldotna is considering the formation of a coordinated care organization pilot. Under that model, this coordinated care organization would be paid a global payment to take care of all of the healthcare services for a population. The CCO, there would be metrics and accountability for quality assigned to that CCO that it would have to meet. And within that global budget, the CCO is empowered to shift resources where they are needed, whether it's on the primary care side, behavioral health, home health, or acute care. The CCO takes risk. So if the cost of the population is more than the global payment or the global budget, they lose money. If their costs are less, there is an opportunity for reward. But if they can manage more care more efficiently with better outcomes and quality, then they're rewarded, so incentives are aligned. So just a few closing points. I'd like to address the discussion that reform should come before expansion. I think this is a reasonable question, and it's an important one to discuss. We believe the answer is no for two reasons. First, Medicaid reform should not be a point-in-time event, but an ongoing process. The healthcare environment is rapidly evolving. Our industry is undergoing disruptive change. And so Medicaid must evolve at the same pace. We shouldn't wait for reform because we should always be doing reform. And the second, innovation and change require resources. If the goal is healthcare system transformation, which is, we think, real meaningful payment reform that helps move the dial on cost, then providers are going to have to take risk, and they're going to have to innovate to create these new models of care. Risk requires capital investment, and in a time of declining resources, where is that going to come from? We think there's the opportunity for that to come from the reduction in uncompensated care through Medicaid expansion. So to say reform first is to starve the system of the resources that are needed to accomplish it. So we're at a crossroads with important choices to make. And I think one of the most important choices we have is the choice to engage in meaningful reform and to commit our state to this effort. We've heard you. You, the legislature, have said reform must happen. And we're here as a hospital association to tell you we agree with you. We're ready to partner in those reform efforts. And reform is real. It can be meaningful, and it is achievable. And expansion is key to achieving reform. So with that, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any questions from Peggy? Senator Stoltz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Holtberg, did you hear, were you listening to Mr. Beeling's testimony?
Through the chair, Senator Stoltz, yes.
And did you have any comments on that? Did that stuff make any sense to you? And is it something that the hospitals are think is a good idea? It's a bad idea? While you're up here, I'd like to ask it.
Through the chair, Senator Stoltz, I'm not familiar with the details of what Mr. Beeling was proposing, so I would hate to comment on it absent those details. Competition, competition is generally a principle that I think is a positive principle. However, again, given the details of that, I can't speak to any of the details.
Well, Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I suspect you do have an opinion. Well, maybe it'll be fleshed out in individual conversations. I wonder how much hospitals think competition is a good idea. I just met a friend I hadn't seen in several years when he went basically out of business because he ran an imaging center in the valley, and I was glad to see him back working in another industry after he scraped everything together after being run out in a non-competitive environment. So I just wonder what the commitment to competition. That was editorial, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Hedberg, for your testimony today. We've had a couple of volunteers. Jeff Jesse. You can introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and help us with this issue, one or both bills, or however you want to present it.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Jeff Jesse. I'm the CEO of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, and I'd like to address both bills. First, the issue of reform. The Mental Health Trust Authority is absolutely convinced that we need Medicaid reform. The Medicaid program is currently constituted and operated, in our opinion, is not sustainable. That's critical for our beneficiaries. If the house of cards continues to get taller and taller, at some point it will collapse, especially under the budgetary and fiscal situation the state finds it in today. If that were to happen, it will take our beneficiaries down with it, and that's unacceptable. And that's one of the reasons that we have been very interested in the reform elements in both of these bills. Because we need to bring the Medicaid program to a more sustainable framework in order to protect our beneficiaries in the long run. Now, as to expansion, obviously from a beneficiary standpoint, expansion is critically important. There are many beneficiaries who do not qualify currently for Medicaid that would qualify for Medicaid under the expansion. And it isn't just about getting them behavioral health care services or other services. It's the fact that they would have access to health insurance, period. And that's critical because we know many of the beneficiaries that are in the expansion target population do not get good health care. They don't get preventative health care. They don't get ongoing disease management for chronic conditions. They tend to get a lot of their health care in the emergency room, which is neither beneficial for them from a health standpoint nor, frankly, helpful from an economic standpoint, as health care, as you all know, in the ER is our most expensive way of getting primary care. Again, many of the elements for reform in both of these bills we feel would go a long way to not only stabilizing the Medicaid program, but also ensuring that our beneficiaries that are eligible under the expansion population are able to get the care that they need at, frankly, a price that we think the state can and should see as a positive fiscal move as opposed to something that exacerbates the current fiscal problems. The other reason that I think you need to look really seriously at expansion is because of other parts of the budget that also need to be brought under control and become sustainable. As you know, right now, corrections is running at 100%, 101% of capacity. It's clear from the recidivism prevention plan that we developed with our other agency partners at the request of the legislature from last session that you're at a crossroads. You're either going to have to continue to allow the growth in the prison population and be forced then to choose between building an additional prison or once again starting to send prisoners out of state at not only that cost, but creating jobs in Texas or Colorado or wherever you're sending them. Or we're going to have to find a way, as with Medicaid, to make the corrections population sustainable from a financial standpoint. The recidivism plan recognizes that there are several main drivers in preventing recidivism. But what it comes down to is to be successful when you leave prison, you need to have a safe place to live, you have to have a job, and you have to have support for recovery. And that third leg of the stool is part and parcel of what the expansion of Medicaid presents as an opportunity. You're either going to have to pay 100% general funds, as you do now in many cases, to provide support for recovery by providing treatment and other support services, or if you choose to accept the expansion, you can shift the majority of that cost, frankly, onto the federal government. And given the fiscal times that we're in, the opportunity to get at least 90% of those treatment and support costs covered by the federal government, to us seems like a really smart financial move, not just from the behavioral health perspective, but from trying to control other parts of the budget, such as corrections. And by the way, when you control the corrections budget and program, it's not just the Department of Corrections whose budget you're getting into a more manageable framework. It rolls down into the public defender, the Department of Law, the court system, not to mention individual police departments and the troopers, because virtually every act of recidivism constitutes a crime, which goes through the entire process and just churns the entire system at great expense. So for those reasons, the trust is supportive not only of the reform efforts in both bills, but are very supportive of the expansion as well.
We have questions for Mr. Jesse. Okay, thank you for your testimony. We had an off-net call in. Be the last person, I guess, on the list here today. Frank McCrory, if you can introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and speak to the bill.
My name is Frank McCrory. I represent myself and wanted to make two brief comments, maybe three. My background includes finance, and also I'm a part of a company that does business process reengineering. Does a lot of workflow analysis and tries to help our clients improve the efficiency of their business operations. From a financial standpoint, I would not disagree with Mr. Jesse or anybody who's testified. I would say good intentions don't always have good results. The idea that you take a system that everybody acknowledges is broken and you will throw more money at it and say we're going to fix it, we're going to save a lot of money. The bigger the system becomes, the more difficult it's going to be to achieve any of the efficiencies or reforms that you're talking about. Ironically, 15 years ago, I was employed by another state agency to help one of their clients with HSS, a severely disabled woman who was not able to get care, health care for herself or her family, but she was still working. She wasn't making any money, but she was not costing the state $22,000 a month, which is what it would have been at that time. And when I went to HSS, with all of my linear bankers thinking and laid down tax returns and said this woman's obviously qualified, the answer I got was, that's way too complicated. We don't have time. The way we determine eligibility is we check the checking account on the first of the month. Can you change your billing cycles? Now, how you determine that we solve that individual problem that a couple of phone calls ascertained, but that's the primary method for checking financial eligibility still. You need to reform the system before you do anything else. If somebody had come to me when I was at the bank and said, gee, we're losing X amount of money every month, but if you lend me some money, we can probably change the way we do business, and we might become profitable. Guess how much of my shareholders' money I would risk on that request? Zero. There's a third thing that at least I might like to understand is true about this, that this is a new class of users. People that were not eligible yesterday on passage of this will become eligible for 100% reimbursement to start with. People that were severely disadvantaged before are going to be staying where they are. It's a 50% reimbursement. And just given the nature of how organizational structures, not to condemn them, they always go in a path that is the most beneficial to them. I understand why the hospitals want this to pass, because they're giving away a lot of free services, and they're going to get paid for them into this. But look at the cascading effects of that. So the most seriously disadvantaged, or perhaps physically handicapped people who are now getting benefits, are the second-class citizens, because their reimbursement is going to be less than 100%, some as low as 50%. And then the senior citizens, such as myself, who have been on Medicare, are going to be another step down the road. Because business is business. These folks are going to pay attention to where they can get the best return on their efforts. I greatly fear that if you optimistically pass this on the assumption that everybody's going to be able to do the right thing and achieve all of these savings, which should be, nothing's going to happen. It's going to be the same as it was 15 years ago and 5 years ago and yesterday. And with the process, with the numbers of people you have, you will not be able to do the job that you've got to do and save, make all of these reforms at the same time. The reforms will need to come first, and then the changes. So that's all I have to say, and I appreciate the offer being accepted by Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I guess we do have one more, and this will be the last one today. Jeremy Price, on the off-net, if you can introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and speak to the bill, please. You got a couple minutes.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jeremy Price. I'm the state director of the Alaska Chapter of Americans for Prosperity, which is a grassroots organization that seeks to limit government, the size of government. In the last several weeks, we've engaged many of Alaskans, asked them to weigh in on this issue, and the response was overwhelming. Alaskans generally, that we have spoken to, do not want further implementation of the Affordable Care Act in the state of Alaska. And the response was so overwhelming, when we tried to connect these literally thousands of Alaskans across the state to their elected officials last week, their phone systems kept shutting down. The response was overwhelming. I would like to point the committee to one paragraph of last year's annual financial report for the state of Alaska. And this is on the second session, second section, page 5. And this is entitled Basis for Qualified Opinions on Governmental Activities and General Funds. This is basically where the accountants, the certified public accountants, determined that they could not successfully audit the state's Medicaid system. And this is what the paragraph says. The state of Alaska's Department of Health and Social Services implemented a new information system to process Medicaid claims during FY14 that generated approximately $1.1 billion in general fund expenditures and $650 million in general fund grants and aid revenue. From the point of implementation, the new Medicaid system contained pervasive, significant defects. Quote, we are unable to obtain sufficient appropriate audit evidence about the expenditures for Medicaid services and related revenues as of June 30, 2014. And the reason I highlight that section is because that's just one indication of how far the Medicaid system has to come in order to be efficient and actually work as it's intended. We find it somewhat ironic that the governor's bill requires no less than 50 audits of providers when a single audit for the state of Alaska's Medicaid system could not be performed by the CPAs. We believe, after years of broken promises from the federal government, we're not convinced the federal government will maintain their promise of maintaining that 90% federal share. And Alaskans we've heard from throughout the state are concerned that the same arguments that are being made today in support of expansion were made by the same proponents of the Affordable Care Act. Most of the witnesses that testified in your committee and others have stated they support expansion. They also support the Affordable Care Act. And the promises that were made when the Affordable Care Act was passed was that our health insurance premiums would be reduced. You're hearing those same promises again, that if we provide federal funding to make up for these uncompensated costs, that insurance, our insurance will go down because we're already paying for these uncompensated care costs. Well, fool me once, right? We know this song and dance. You've heard it before. Let's not go down this road. Let's focus on reform. Senator situation again.
Okay.
That's my testimony.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. You have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A real quick one. At one of our first meetings, I asked the commissioner, said she was going to work with all stakeholders, and you're a group that represents taxpayers. What kind of outreach have you had from the department to inquire, involve, or just general outreach and contact?
You can have the commissioner.
I'm asking him if he can describe what outreach he's received first, I think, was my question.
Okay.
Mr. Price. Received any outreach from this department.
Thank you.
Okay, we have any other questions? Okay, that concludes our public hearing portion for both bills today, Senate Bill 74 and Senate Bill 78. We're going to set these bills aside for further review and some work to be done. Again, we will not have a meeting Friday as the working bees are busy in the beehive dealing with the situation at hand. And we will be posting a schedule at the end of the week for next week. And we are adjourned.